You're listening to World Watchers International over FM 102 KLRB, and now here's May with part two.
Several weeks ago, December the 20th, I went at great length on this program to detail the headlines of the Libyan hit team crisis because I knew it was a crock of baloney, and I wanted to follow it in chronological order, showing you the sources of information from Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times, L.A. Times, just continuously with that garbage that the White House was sending out. And I dated on the sheet that accompanies with the tape all that kind of business and left off with December the 20th, the various stories that I didn't believe at all that Gaddafi had sent a hit team to kill the president or the people in Washington, D.C., that had their expensive limousines and security, that whole thing across this country, about $750,000 for 2 weeks of security. Well, December 25th, the next week, the Washington Post has an article, Libyan hit team are reported to suspend their activity. Isn't that cute? December the 27th, there was an article in the Houston Post and the editorial page called Overkill that just about explained it. And this gentleman wrote, as someone who worked in Libya for 5 years, maybe I be allowed to offer a few comments on the developments. What an overkill. What bamboozling nonsense. Are we fed daily by Washington and Israeli spokesmen on TV and newspapers and so forth? I firmly believe, on the basis of two decades of evidence, that the main purpose of U.S. foreign policy is to create the maximum number of enemies at the highest cost to American taxpayers. This is the Washington Post. Vietnam was the most glaring proof of this theory. Libya is the most recent example. With all the half-baked, half-cocked accusations leveled against Libya and Colonel Gaddafi, no one reckons with that famous terrorist from the King David Hotel to his latest massacre in Beirut, Mr. Begin, whose killings add up to several proven hundreds versus Gaddafi's unproven few. Gaddafi is called by our world leaders the most dangerous man in the world or the most vicious international outlaw. Bah humbug. In competition with our friends, Begin or Pinochet in Chile, he's a poor runner-up at best. Perhaps the real aim of the makers of our foreign policy, and again, that's Brzezinski and Kissinger and that gang, is to create a bundle of nations like Iran, where those in power are frenziedly anti-American along religious lines. We are the great, and they are Satan. And in this opposition, we are simply, if they are for, lining up against us and for the Soviet Union, they are pro-Satan. They are Satan if they are pro-Soviet, if they turn against us. This article, it's on the editorial page, just calls it a crock of baloney, and that's what I call it. That was the 27th of December. Now, January the 4th, 1982, Mr. Webster, the FBI, comes out and says the FBI never confirmed the murder plot by Libya. There's a possibility we would look silly, but we have no proof of a hit squad at all. This was on January the 4th. To show you the kind of lies we get, Libyan hit squad's unconfirmed FBI director says, and the New York Daily News was still carrying a story of the jackal's bite is rabid. The trail of blood winds through Europe and the Middle East. Carlos, the most notorious terrorist in the world, New York Daily News, still pushing that out, and the FBI had absolutely no proof. They said it can't be confirmed and that the U.S. officials were conned. Jack Anderson had an article on that. But a lot of baloney, a lot of press coverage with the limousines pulling up in the conferences. Now the White House waltz. We'll do some more on who's on top in the White House, because March 29th, almost a year ago, and I keep referring to that evening, I analyzed the top dogs are fighting, and I named Alexander Haig, Walter Stessel, Richard Pipes, Richard Allen, and William Casey. Now, Alexander Haig won the battle, obviously, in the State Department, in the National Security Council. He's top dog still. He is running the show. He's the protege of Henry Kissinger, Fritz Kramer, Reinhard Gehlend, and the Nazi team. Walter Stessel is on top. He was head of the United States Embassy, the chief there in the Soviet Union when Lee and Marina Oswald worked with Navy intelligence. He was our ambassador also to Germany and to Poland. He's now deputy to Stessel. He's moved up to take Mr. Clark's place. Clark's the watchdog is out. Stessel is on top with Alexander Haig. Richard Pipes is making Soviet policy in the National Security Council. He's very silent, and we're not hearing much of Pipes yet, but you will. Richard Allen is out. He has been kicked out of the National Security Council for scandals that weren't even mentioned in the $1,000 check that was found or cash in his desk. Allen is out, and William Casey is next to go. Why are Allen and Casey out and Haig and Stessel on top? Mostly because Allen and Casey's backgrounds are so sleazy. I've mentioned many times the links to organized crime, to Robert Vesco, to the early assassination teams. They're so interwoven that they're easy to pull out, and you'll be seeing in the weeks to come that William Casey is out. Haig and Stessel, the scoreboard, are on top. Newspaper articles, Reagan okays Haig's choice for State Department jobs. Haig helped make them. You saw the picture of my mention down New Year's at Annenberg's, smiling with Ronald Reagan. I want to say Nixon because Nixon's in touch with the White House almost all the time, I read recently. Reagan, Haig confer on policy in Palm Springs. San Jose Mercury has an editorial page, Alexander Haig, statesman. He was a disaster in Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Iran, wherever he touches, Chile, but he's called the elder statesman. And Reagan confers with Haig on what to do about Allen. Now, Haig was worried that there was trouble in the White House. Somebody was out to get him, but he pulled the rug and he got Allen out. Reagan backs Haig all the way. So it's hard to uproot Haig. Haig knows too much. He and Butterfield, Alexander Butterfield, set up the taping system in the White House that got Richard Nixon out of office and made the Defense Department really take over the White House. That was when the Admiral Moore from the Navy and the Alexander Haig from the Pentagon really came in and swept old Tricky Dick out of office, taping him. And the tapes are locked up now on the flimsy excuse we can't afford to hear them, because maybe if we heard them, we would have Haig out also. They don't have the funds to review the tapes. Why don't let somebody volunteer to do it? If we heard the full tapes, the ones that they threw away and the ones they saved, you wouldn't have to look at Haig's face or Kissinger or Brzezinski or any of them, because I say they're war criminals and they should be out. But the tapes are locked up on the excuse that the budget cut won't let you have Nixon's tapes, so they're only protecting themselves. The way the Pentagon got Allen out was really cute. It was described in the Washington Post December the 12th, the best article on the way that Allen slid out and the role of the Pentagon. This article tells about William French Smith, the attorney general who wanted to close the inquiry quickly before it got too large. And it was the story of the intercepted money that was kept in the office of Richard Allen. But the chronology went like this. Tom DeCare from the Justice Department announced, "We will continue the investigation," even though the attorney general wanted to close it. The investigation cleared up a lot of problems, but according to the Washington Post, it made more mysteries and created mysteries rather than clearing it up. Allen had said, "I helped the housewife's friend, a Japanese magazine, to arrange an interview with Nancy Reagan." And Mrs. Reagan said, according to the Washington Post, that she was not interviewed. Now, it's interesting. When all this controversy was going on, Mrs. Reagan was not interviewed by the FBI. And the question is, why not? Allen said he intercepted the envelope with a sheaf of paper for Mrs. Reagan. It doesn't say intercepting it, how he could do that if it was meant for Mrs. Reagan. Now, there was a large outer envelope that had the mark $10,000 on the outside, and allegedly there was $1,000 in $100 bills. And he took this envelope, it was meant for Nancy, and allegedly he never told her, but probably it was never meant for her. Now, there were at least three other people, according to the Washington Post, who knew about the money. It wasn't turned to the Treasury, and it was kept by Richard Allen. Now, the first one, Irene Darras, is Allen's secretary, and she took the blame for failing to turn the money over to the government as the payment for the picture. The FBI report A second secretary saw the money, the $1,000 in the safe, in February, the month after it was put in the safe. This is right after the inauguration. A third secretary notified Richard Allen's secretary it was in the safe, and this woman told her of the contents of the safe and turned it over to Colonel Donald Johnson. Now, that's where the Pentagon and Haig get into this. The third secretary turns it to Colonel Donald Johnson, who was the assistant to the National Security Advisor of Allen. Now, you would think that Allen's advisor would then tell him what's going on, but a colonel from the military, who's the assistant to Allen, gets the envelope, and Colonel Donald Johnson from the National Security Council put it and packages into two drawer safe where he left them. Then he leaves the National Security Council. It's in the hands of a colonel, and he leaves the National Security Council in March 81 with his money in a drawer. Now, Colonel Johnson, was he in on the payoff, or what did he know? But he left it in the drawer. Now, the money wasn't discovered until September 15th. It sits in there from March to September. It's been handed over in January, a little envelope that says $10,000 on the outside. They've used the president's wife as excuse when it's discovered. But in the meanwhile, this is sitting in a desk in January. A woman secretary sees it in February. A third person sees it and gives it to a colonel in March. In September, three military officers receive the money. Not Allen, three military. And remember, Alexander Haig is Pentagon military. They go into Allen's office. They see the envelope. In Japanese, it says 100,000, but they say there's only supposed to be 1,000. Now, they turn the envelope and the items over to National Security employees, not Richard Allen. And the National Security employees took them to Edwin Meese on September the 21st. And Meese turned them over to the FBI on September the 21st and didn't tell Richard Allen. Now, Nancy Reagan allegedly wants Meese out of the White House. I imagine she wants him out of the White House because the whole thing brought her name down. Now, what does she want him out for? Well, they'll give him a job maybe as the Attorney General. You know, he was a prosecutor in Alameda County in California, which is a dumb job. He wasn't well known for it. He's been a behind-the-scenes manipulator for Ronald Reagan. And they don't care what we get. If we get some scum like John Mitchell, I guess we can get any kind of attorney general. It doesn't matter. Just get him out of my hair. Nancy wants Meese out of the White House. And I think she wants him out of the White House is because Meese did not tell Allen. The whole thing could have been hushed the way that they do their payments and under-the-table things. But the point is that the whole thing was handled by the military, by a Colonel Donald Johnson, by three military officers, by Meese, and then the FBI, and that was the scandal. So the FBI concentrated on the bribery laws and the prohibition against public officials accepting gifts. They concentrated on that, and they didn't go into detail about the lies that Richard Allen said about selling his firm, Potomac International. He said he sold it in 1978, and it was a mistake. He sold it in 1980. How can you make a lie like that? National Security Advisor making lies like that. He had money into it, $100,000 to $250,000 at the end of 1980, and he said he sold it a long time ago. There was a cartoon in a newspaper a while back of a gentleman sitting at a desk, and there's three Japanese women. I might have mentioned it on one of the programs, and the person at the desk is saying, yes, Secretary Haig had three Japanese journalists here for an interview. And then somebody on the phone is saying, that's the third time this week Allen has tried this. So this is Haig being sent Japanese people for an interview, and Haig is holding on. Allen has tried it. But that was the chain of command. That's how Allen got out, Richard Allen, and Haig was on top. They've had this fight ever since they got in to office. There are too many biggies grabbing power in the White House and too many people that have the goods on each other. And that's why it makes an interesting administration, because of their past cover-ups and the way that they're fighting each other. So Alexander Haig, he didn't like Mr. Clark, William Clark, nosing him. Ronald Reagan came right out in the newspaper and various press conferences. he was brought there to be the watchdog on Haig because Ronald Reagan didn't want Haig to have so much power in the State Department. But the watchdog is gone. The Bow Wow is gone. And Haig is unleashed for all he's worth with those fangs coming out and trying to go to Europe now to make peace with NATO. Now, Alexander Haig has been a failure, as far as I can see, in American policy and the way this country is going bankrupt through their ridiculous policies. He was the head of NATO. One of his NATO associates was arrested or under indictment in Italy for working with Licio Gelli to want a fascist Nazi regime in Italy. Haig was head of NATO, and NATO is falling apart. He's trying to get a semblance of cooperation this week in Brussels. There was a picture of him leaving all the elder statesmen at Andrews Air Force Base, getting on the plane. The news accounts of the meeting are that they will have a verbal attack against the Soviet Union, but actually there isn't much they can do. The European nations can trade with the Soviet Union. They can exist in peace. They can exchange gas and other things with each other if the United States would stay out of it. But the United States doesn't appreciate the alliance that's building up around Europe, the confidence in the Soviet Union that they're losing in us. So Haig is off to Brussels this week on that matter. But he's got William Clark out from his hair, and he's got the whole State Department, which he's turning into a Pentagon for himself. And Clark has the position there now. There was a cartoon, a brutal cartoon of Clark running the State Department this week and not knowing one country from the other. It was outrageous. Now, Allen is out, Richard Allen. Last Sunday night, I said he would be out by Monday. He was out for sure. But he said on the news accounts, if you saw him, it was a political reason he was out. He did it for the president. He served the president, and Reagan is keeping him on the payroll. Now, Ronald Reagan is cutting budgets. He's looking for ways to save money and save billions. I suggest that he drop Richard Allen. If the guy did something wrong, drop him. If he didn't do anything wrong, why did you let him go? So he's on full payroll as an advisor. Allen knows too much to be dropped. They have to put him on some kind of a payroll or else let him write a book or make a movie like all these other creeps to pull in some cash. But Richard Allen is a part of the fabric of the whole era, from World War II to the present. He knows too much about the espionage activities, the dirty tricks, the real dirty tricks. So they can't let him go totally, and they have to work with him. That party in Washington, incidentally, where they had the farewell party for Richard Allen, I mentioned a few people that were there out of the hundreds. One, Jesse Helms of North Carolina, Jerry Falwell, Richard Simon, Joseph Kaur, the beer magnate, the very who's who of the far-right administration that got their power and their profits through political assassinations and the manipulations of the average person, the corporations, really the dirty work that it takes to get to the top in this country, the who's who and what's what. Those were the people, the Buckleys, and that gang, the Ernest Lefebvre, who was working and representing or lobbying for Nestle's, that gang had to support Allen at the same time that they are the right hand of Ronald Reagan. So Richard Allen is going to get his salary, at least for the time being. He'll be on the payroll. He's out as National Security Advisor. William Clark will be the National Security Advisor, even though he doesn't know one country from the other. Haig has him out from under his hair. And now there's supposed to be a new job for Mr. Meese, Edwin Meese. He's going to be promoted, as I say, put him in as the Attorney General, give him anything he wants. Didn't he turn the Allen papers over to the FBI? Let's make him the Attorney General. Last week he was going to resign for government. This week he's going to be the Attorney General. And there's stories. First Lady advisors want Meese moved. Why would the First Lady want him out? She denies that she has anything to do with the policy outside of her beauty parlor and West Wing of the White House. She doesn't make policy. But you better believe Nancy Reagan makes policy. And if Allen was smearing the name of Nancy Reagan or if Meese was involved in that and turned this over and it brought out that scandal, even if it helped Alexander Haig and made that White House shuffle, she and others want Meese out, so okay, let's let him be the Attorney General. Give the people anything. Now, Walter Stessel has been moved deputy under Alexander Haig. I told you that's the big job, the former ambassador to the Soviet Union with Leon Morena. The Navy intelligence team from the Soviet Union that were involved in the murder of John Kennedy, that worked with Mr. Pipes and George Bush, the CIA and Defense Department, John Paisley, Walter Stessel, the whole assassination team from the Soviet Union to the National Security Council that know who killed John Kennedy and were a part of it have moved very strategically into their places. As a matter of fact, Haig had a role in the U-2 flight and worked with the Defense Department through this whole operation. I think I was the first researcher in the United States to say that the downing of the U-2 involved Nazis from Argentina, like Alexander Zeiger, the CIA, Marine and Lee Oswald in Navy intelligence. I was talking about that at the Boston Conference on Assassinations in 1975. And I was isolated from the other researchers because 80% of them, or 40% of them, worked for the CIA, like Bernard Fensterwald and the Assassination Information Bureau in Boston that moved to Washington. 40 to 50% of the researchers worked with the intelligence community to keep the lid on the real truth, and the other 60% are too stupid to know the difference. The real story of who killed John Kennedy has to do with what Lee Harvey Oswald was doing with the Soviet Union, the role of Marina Oswald in the Soviet Union when she came back with him, their role with George de Morenschild, the Nazi spy. I've been outlining this on various programs and brought details of that to a seminar to the Boston Conference, but that was didn't make any headlines. It wasn't written up by other researchers because it was ignored. It was the number one story of the Kennedy assassination. So what we get today, the price we have to pay for ignoring that, for looking the other direction, for the assassins of John Kennedy, for fingering even the anti-Castro Cubans or organized crime, and not looking to the top, what you end up with is Haig and Walter Stessel and George Bush and the whole intelligence operation that have been behind these assassinations and have now slid into base, into the White House, the State Department, the National Security Department. Walter Stessel is a cutie. I used to be in love with Walter Stessel. He lived next door to us. I might have mentioned this on a program before. Our driveway was right next to his. Our houses were side by side. His family sold the home about 10, 15 years ago. He went to Beverly High. He was a senior when I was a freshman, but he was awfully good looking. He'd come home and I'd sit at the piano, the music room, back right to where he parked his car and got out, and I'd sit and play that song, Love and Bloom. If any of you are old enough to remember the song Love and Bloom, I used to pound it on the piano when Walter would come in the driveway. He went on to Stanford. He was ahead of me. He was a senior when I was a freshman at Stanford. I never kept up the contacts. My family saw his mother several months ago or half a year ago. His father's passed away. They were our next-door neighbor on Walden Drive in Beverly Hills. Walter was groomed for the State Department from the time he was at Beverly High and had the right contacts and the right controls at Stanford, went on to Brazil, and then went to the Soviet Union and Poland and Germany. And now the career diplomat is in the State Department. The San Jose Mercury has an article, Career Diplomat Stessel, named Deputy Secretary of State, as if this were a breakaway from the way the appointments are made. But it's very important to know that Stessel has worked with this team very closely going back, I can figure, the Kennedy assassination. Now, one comment, we have five more minutes on this program, and I want to talk about a social event in Houston, Texas, described at Christmas time. The Bushes spend their holidays in Washington, Capitol Christmas, and this is the Houston Post. And among other things in this article, it mentions that the home that the Bushes have in Washington and how it's been refurbished by friends like the White House apartment of the Reagans. This fall, Bush had King Hussein of Jordan for a business lunch, and the present president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, was the guest at George Bush's home 2 days before Anwar Sadat was assassinated. Now, keep in mind that George Bush was director of the CIA, and there were headlines CIA knew 2 weeks and 2 days and that Sadat was going to be murdered. And his successor was at the home of George Bush. Then the article says, currently Mrs. Bush is finishing a set of 17 phone calls to parents of the Peace Corps volunteers she met on a trip to Ghana. The mail to Ghana, she said, is 3 months late, so she's calling the families personally. Now, I didn't read that Mrs. Bush went to Ghana in December, and I don't read where she travels very often. Maybe you do. But 2 or 3 weeks after, by January the 1st, 2 weeks later, Ghana had a bloody coup. And the bloody takeover was staged in Ghana, January the 1st. The headlines, Ghana's rulers dismiss parliament and ban politics. Leadership of Ghana coup orders the halt to looting. Ghana's ex-president is arrested. And I ask the question, is Mrs. George Bush a bag woman for that coup in Ghana that took place several weeks after she was there? You see, Mrs. Hunt, Dorothy Hunt, was a CIA superior to E. Howard Hunt, and he was in the CIA for 21 years. And she was the CIA chief in Madrid in Spain when Otto Skorzeny and Nazis with links to the Odessa, South America, United States were thick in Spain. Dorothy Hunt was a bag woman for the CIA. Frank Turpel's wife was a bag woman, a makeup woman for the CIA, who was taken to the airport by Rita Jenrette when she fled the country, when her husband was being sought and arrested. Many wives, most of the wives of the CIA people, are CIA agents. Gary Powers' wife wrote that in her book about being married to Gary Powers, whose U2 broke d'entente in Russia and broke the peace conferences at that time. They go to special training schools, and they married to CIA people. Now, Mrs. George Bush, we might have overlooked that lovely lady who takes her trip to Ghana, and then several weeks later, there is this coup in Ghana and the government, the bloody takeover in Ghana. They entertain Mubarak, and 2 days later, Mubarak is the president of Egypt. Interesting social column to see what links and how many times Mrs. George Bush is in Ghana. The article says that she was personally phoning 17 people who were in the Peace Corps over there. Maybe she was alerting them that something would be happening, but they shouldn't worry. This is a thought that we have overlooked about the wife of the CIA director and where she travels. And there wasn't much except one newspaper that she was in Ghana. And it's interesting when these coups take place to see who was traveling there just prior to the coup. And are these people bag people who carry the money or give the final okay? Certainly the final okay can't be given on the telephone. And it has to be given personally, and it has to be given at a conference time to go ahead. And Mrs. George Bush is in Ghana, and a couple weeks later they have a coup. I think we have to think about that, because George Bush, as CIA director, had a direct role in the overthrow of Chile with Salvador Allende, and as a CIA director covering up the murder of Orlando Letelier in this country. I've warned you many times or discussed with you the danger of George Bush and his proximity to the American coup of the Hinckley family, so I wouldn't put it past them. If they would try it in America, they can do it in Ghana. It's something to think about. Well, next week we'll get back to some more of these very interesting events. They are nauseating, but they are interesting, and they are evolving in ways that some writers are catching on, editorials and comments that are interesting. I'll be back with you next week with more of this kind of information. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California.
This has been World Watchers International with noted conspiracy investigator Mae Brussel. This program originates from Carmel, California.
KLRB, Carmel, Monterey.